Thank you. Be seated.
Justice Spector has recused herself in this case, and the court is ready to hear argument from petitioner, City of San Antonio versus Rodriguez.
May it please the court, Mr. Lowell Benton and Ms. Sarah Duncan will be representing the petitioner. Ms. Duncan will be speaking for the first 14 minutes, and Mr. Benton has another 6 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, my name is Sarah Duncan. Lowell Benton and I are here today on behalf of the City of San Antonio. It's been a long road to this court, and we appreciate the opportunity to present this case on the merits. A wise judge once said that the key to any appeal and the question he wants answered during oral argument is why. Why did the lawyers do at trial whatever it is they did to cause the complaint of error, if it's error? I think that's a particularly important question in this case. And for that reason, while I understand the court is generally familiar with the facts, I'd like to briefly summarize. In late May and early June of 1987, it rained a lot in San Antonio. On June 3rd in the morning, Sandra Rodriguez was driving west on West Laurel Street towards the intersection of La Jolla. This intersection is in the Five Points area of San Antonio, one of the oldest areas of the city. Now, there is a factual dispute in our brief in the trial court, and apparently that will remain with us, as to whether Ms. Rodriguez attempted to proceed through the intersection that was filled with water. The city has cited Statement of Fact, page 532. We went back and checked that. That is the testimony. We went back through last night and this morning the testimony of the eyewitnesses, and we are not able to find any testimony that suggests that she did not attempt to proceed through the intersection. The Rodriguez's have asserted that as a fact in their Statement of Fact, but they don't cite a record reference, and we can't find one. In any event, her car was swept by the floodwaters into a box culvert that had been placed under this street in 1931. At the time, the intersection was not marked as a low water crossing, and there were no guardrails to prevent a car from being swept off into the creek. Now, any person with any sensitivity at all will recognize that this case involves perhaps the worst tragedy that can possibly occur, the death of a child. And we do not mean to minimize in any way that this case involves a tragic accident. But if the fact of a tragedy established the city's liability, we wouldn't be here. It's rules of law that establish the city's liability, and we're here to discuss two with the court. First, the familiar rule of law, that it is the plaintiff's burden to plead, prove, request, and obtain findings to support a judgment. And second, that there must be legally cognizable evidence to support the jury's findings. Now, any good trial lawyer, and the Rodriguez's certainly have good trial lawyers, would recognize from hearing these facts three potential proof problems. First, many of the factors that coalesced to cause this accident are purely within the discretionary functions of the city. And for those discretionary functions, the city has absolute immunity. Second proof problem, given what at least the jury could have inferred about Ms. Rodriguez's conduct, given that the city logs did not reflect that the city received a high water call in the Five Points area that day until after this accident, how would these facts translate into comparative fault findings? Third proof problem, how do you show that the Pike, City of Gladewater versus Pike standard for gross negligence against a municipality is met when it is undisputed that the city marked close to 200 other low water crossings in and around San Antonio. Now, with these three proof problems in mind, I'd like to focus on the court's charge, and specifically question one, which sort of looks like a premise defect question, question two, which is a straight-up negligence question, question three, nuisance, and question six, the Pike, City of Gladewater versus Pike, gross negligence.
Ms. Dunham, before you begin that, let me ask a question. It would appear to me that the City of San Antonio had made the decision to mark low water crossings.
Yes.
That's undisputed. It seems to me that prior to the Tort, Tort Claims Act amendment, when you talked about a proprietary versus discretionary function on street maintenance, you had a policy decision which was governmental immunity, and then you had an implementation provision that was not immune. If the City of San Antonio made the policy decision to mark low water crossings, and at this street failed to mark this street, is there any question that that's a proprietary function?
Not in city. That is a proprietary function, and that's what the jury should have been restricted to.
And so what you are focusing on now is, was that question submitted to the jury?
What we are focusing on is, that's certainly part of it, but the problem in this case is that the evidence that the Rodriguez has introduced was not restricted to the failure to warn or to mark the intersection. It incorporated the initial design. It went all the way back to the days of carriages in San Antonio.
And so your argument is the question was so broad that it would allow the jury to have an affirmative finding based on the question for conduct that was clearly policy decision, not implementation.
The original design of the street, the location of the street, the decision not to expend funds to make this intersection an all-weather crossing, those are all purely discretionary functions. And if the court will look at question one, which we've provided copies of to the court, and particularly at subsection 4B, the jury is asked if the city had actual knowledge or constructive notice of a dangerous, unreasonably dangerous condition. Subsection 4B defines the condition being inquired about as floodwater from San Pedro Creek flowing over West Laurel Street at or near its intersection with Lahar. Now, what that means, in the city's view, is that the jury could answer question one yes if it found only that the city had constructive notice of the fact of the floodwaters. That doesn't establish negligence. And it certainly doesn't establish negligence in the performance of a proprietary function. Now, the Rodriguez's argue that you don't look at question one standing alone. You've got to look at question one and question two, and we're happy to do that. Turning to question two, on the occasion in question, did the city commit any negligent act or omission which was a proximate cause of Ms. Rodriguez's death? On its face, the question and instructions do not restrict the jury to negligence in the performance of a proprietary function. The jury can answer question two, yes, if it finds only that the city was negligent in some respect in deciding not to use capital improvement funds to make this intersection an all-weather crossing. Now, the Rodriguez's say, yes, but question two was conditioned on an affirmative answer to question one. And that's true. It is. But the fact of conditioning doesn't tie any of the conditions in question one to the negligence in question two. All it did was instruct the jury, you can't answer question two unless you've already answered question one yet. And even if it did tie the negligence in question two to one of the questions in one of the subparts of question one, you still got the problem with subpart B. The jury could have found and answered both of these questions yes, only that the city was negligent in some respect, not necessarily proprietary, but in some respect, and it had actual knowledge or constructive notice of the fact of the floodwaters. So what questions one and two together do is solve the proof problem, the first two proof problems. What they don't do is establish negligence in the performance of a proprietary function. And the Rodriguez's have to have that to support this judgment for actual damages in excess of the caps in the Tort Claims Act. What the very strange questions one and two also did was permit the jury in apportioning fault between Ms. Rodriguez and the city to consider all of the city's discretionary and governmental functions. They weren't restricted to, for instance, the duty to warn or make the intersection safe. Now, question three is, on its face, encompasses purely discretionary functions. Question three, the nuisance question, asks whether the city, through its design, discretionary, construction, proprietary, location, discretionary, and or maintenance, proprietary, of West Laurel Street at its intersection with and or over San Pedro Creek, create or maintain a nuisance. So even if you can get past the city's viewpoint that this doesn't establish private nuisance, because there are no property rights or private property involved, even if you can get past that we don't think it establishes a public nuisance, because this intersection wasn't inherently dangerous, it was only dangerous in combination with the floodwaters, even if you can get past those things, this question still doesn't establish the city's fault in the performance of a proprietary function. And as Justice Reveley said in City of Houston versus George, you can't use nuisance to evade sovereign immunity. He relies on Braun versus trustees of Victoria Independent School District, in part, a 1938 writ refused case from San Antonio. But question three, like questions one and two, solve the first two proof problems. Now question six is, I still haven't figured out everything there is to figure out, I'm sure, about question six. Question six is the exemplary, the gross negligence question under Pike. In Pike, this court held that a plaintiff seeking to recover exemplary damages against the city has to show, and I quote, intentional, willful, wanton or grossly negligent acts which show malice or evil intent. But the jury in this case was instructed that it could infer conscious indifference from actions where, under the surrounding circumstances, a reasonable person would have realized that his conduct created an extreme degree of risk to the safety of others. So the jury wasn't told that it had to find actual conscious indifference, as this court recently held in Walmart versus Alexander. My time is up. Thank you.
May I ask you, and I'll ask Mr. Mendelson when he steps to the podium, I was on the district bench during the time this case was proceeding in Bexar County, and I haven't reviewed the transcript to see if I presided over any contested hearings in this case. Do you know of any?
I certainly don't. I've been through every page of the transcript and have not seen any.
Thank
you. Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, the respondents would represent
believe you did preside over one hearing where involved in this case involving a contempt issue. So, yes, I believe you did. I apologize for not bringing that before the court, to the court's attention, but Mr. Jackson will not.
I'll look into it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Mendelson, do you agree that the policy decisions behind whether or not to mark the intersection is a governmental function, and the failure to mark it once that decision is made is a proprietary function?
No, sir. You have to look at this case in the posture that it is now. This is a proprietary function case. The trial court so found, the Court of Appeals so found, and at page 19, I believe it is, of the appellant's brief, or the petitioner's brief, you can see they've abandoned the point that this is not a proprietary function case under the amended Tort Claims Act. The decision to mark low water crossings.
I was just asking the general proposition. Do you agree that the policy decision to mark an intersection of low water is governmental versus the decision that failed to mark it as being proprietary?
It depends upon how the city works. In the city of San Antonio, you have a council manager government, Your Honor. In the charter, the responsibility for carrying out all the public works functions are given to the administrative agency known as the Public Works Division of the city of San Antonio. To that extent, it may be determined that the decision to mark or not to mark a low water crossing may well be a carrying out of a policy. If the city council says you will mark low water crossings, and then the manner in which it is carried out by the Public Works Department then makes everything that they do, whether to mark this one or that one or the other one, to that extent, that policy decision, if you want to call it a policy decision, would be administrative. Whether to mark them at all would be a governmental function. So to answer your question, the decision whether to mark any particular one, I believe, is an administrative determination, and it's a determination that is proprietary completely. Whether they mark it carefully or not is also proprietary. But whether they mark this particular one was strictly proprietary because of the duty and the responsibility to mark was given to the Public Works Director and the Public Works Department in the charter, and Maria Berriozabal, who was the council representative in the district where this young lady drowned, so testified.
You testified to what?
She testified that it was expected by the council that the Public Works Department would carefully mark and protect, and if they didn't mark, and if they couldn't have bridges, or if they couldn't make them safe, that they would barricade. So the entire responsibility for maintaining the streets in a reasonably safe condition during heavy rainpour, during high water times, during flooding times, was left to the Public Works Department of the City of San Antonio.
I noticed that in the opinion of concurring Judge Rickoff in the Court of Appeals, that he suggests that the testimony of former Mayor Henry Cisneros essentially amounted to the city confessing error with reference to this.
Yes, sir. And I think that there was testimony from both Mayor Cisneros and Council Representative Berriozabal that showed that the city had actual knowledge, as was found by the trial court and as was found by the Court of Appeals as a matter of fact, not as a matter of law, but as a matter of fact, so that it is not reviewable, using a proper legal standard. Now, I realize that the standard would be reviewable, but they did use a proper legal standard. As a matter of fact, that the city had actual knowledge of the three things that are contained in the first issue, those three conditions on which issue number two is conditioned. I would like to get out of the way very quickly, if I may, the complaint that is made by counsel as to these issues, because this is a proprietary function case, and because the law has been established since 1884 in the Poznanski case that there is a common law duty to exercise ordinary care that may not even be abrogated by a statute, because this court in Hanks against City of Port Arthur in 1932, which is a case that we didn't cite to you, but cited to the Court of Appeals for a different purpose, held that it was a violation of the open court's provision of the Constitution to require that a city be liable only if it had prior actual notice, I mean actual knowledge rather, of a street defect. It was a sidewalk trip and fall case, and the Supreme Court held that it was a violation of the open courts provision to require, to abrogate the common law and require actual knowledge. So this whole conversation about actual knowledge is foolhardy, considering the law that's been established since 1884, 1932, and really through the 1980s by this court. The answer to the question is that where this confusion is, how could it be determined that it's a proprietary function, is answered by this court in City of Austin against Daniels in 1960, an opinion written by Chief Justice Greenhill, where there are issues of proprietary and governmental functions that may be confusing to the jury, and if there's evidence of both, that is, that the harm that the wrong that caused the harm could be considered an instrumentality of a proprietary function as well as an instrumentality of a governmental function, then they merge together and become proprietary. And according to the Court of Appeals in Beaumont in the City of Houston against Bush, which is a case that has been cited favorably many times, the burden is upon the city to offer an issue and to obtain a finding that whatever it was that caused the harm was not proprietary, was in fact governmental. That didn't happen in this case.
Why isn't that an inferential rebuttal?
It is an affirmative defense, according to this court's decision in Davis against the City of San Antonio, that there's governmental immunity. And so they would have to gain, the city would have to assert its affirmative defense of immunity.
Well, there are many affirmative defenses. Sometimes they have to be submitted separately, but sometimes it would be an inferential rebuttal to submit it separately.
May I suggest to the court that it would be a change in the law for this court to now hold that it was that and that it would not be the burden of the defendant to obtain a finding, because that in the Davis case the court held where the city did not seek its immunity, it waived it.
This was pled, though. I mean, there's no question the city pled.
Oh, that's correct. They pled immunity, but they did not go forward with obtaining a jury finding in light of the fact that there was, see, the question before the court is a question of law. The question of law that was decided by the trial court and then confirmed by the Court of Appeals, and which is not before this court, is that this is a proprietary function case. There was no issue.
Davis was purely a pleading case, though.
Sir?
Davis was purely a pleading.
Yes.
There's no affirmative finding required of sovereign immunity, or at least on the basis of that case.
The cases that I'm relying upon would be Bush, the City of Houston against Bush, Crow against City of San Antonio by this court, where a rope across a street was considered to be a governmental function, but it was involved an issue of maintaining the street safely, and there was merger. The Kling case, which is a no-writ history case out of Austin in 1932, I believe it, which has been cited by the Supreme Court a number of times, where there was a fire hydrant, which was in the middle of a roadway, and it created an obstruction.
Well,
so all of these cases, when you
your
take
argument them, is you, that it would not have done any good for the city to submit an issue on whether it was governmental or not, because if it was partly governmental and partly proprietary, they're liable for it as if it were all proprietary.
That is what the stare decisis of this court holds, but if they wish to submit an issue, they could have if the trial court
wouldn't serve its purpose.
Actually, that is correct.
It's not really, you said earlier it's an affirmative defense, but it's not an affirmative defense.
Under the facts of this case, it is not. Under the facts of this case, it is clearly not.
Mr. Mendelson, is it your position, I'm trying to clarify governmental versus proprietary, is it your position that the design of a bridge is a proprietary function?
It depends, Your Honor. Normally, the cases hold that strict design is governmental.
What I understand from Mr. Duncan's argument, she's not arguing that this is a governmental immunity versus proprietary. What she is arguing is that question number two, which asks merely negligence, could permit the jury to have an affirmative finding solely on the basis of the roadway design opposed to a failure to mark. What in the context of the case as it was tried or from the language and any of the definitions used could the jury have been limited in scope to considering only proprietary function?
In the first place, the only reason why there was a pleading about the bridges, and the only reason for the pleading about bridges was the fact that the city of San Antonio had an ordinance that required that all of the low water crossings be raised to a level of having to against a 25-year flood unless it was a situation where they had to have a bridge for a 100-year flood. So we pled the ordinance. We pled the ordinance, and that's the basis of the bridge issue, insofar as any negligence is concerned. It was a negligence per se issue. Every one of the matters that are cited on page 16 of the brief of the petition relates solely and strictly to proprietary functions. The issue of the design, we never submitted any issue of negligence. There was never any testimony of negligence about the design of the bridge. And the way I want the court to understand how this came down was that we submitted the case on three bases. There was obstruction in the roadway, which we considered to be the floodwaters. This is, and I understand, and I want to distinguish this case from the Kitchens case. The Kitchens case is an ice on a bridge case. Our position is that an obstruction in a roadway is something that prevents vehicles from passing through. Ice on a roadway can be distinguished because you slide right on through, and it was something that could be anticipated. From the testimony that was in this case, a driver could not tell. There were exhibits that were offered that showed that a driver could not tell if the water was running or not, or how deep the water was. And we considered, like in the Miranda case, that is a NORIF case, but and a special defect case, but still, it is an obstruction in a roadway case, a floodwater case, we relied upon that. So we had an obstruction in the roadway as being a maintenance issue. We had the failure to barricade, which is City of Austin against Schmiedes, an opinion written by Judge Calvert. And then we have Dilley against the City of Houston, which is written by Chief Justice Griffin, which is a storm sewer case. City of against Lee, which says that if you have to put barriers and if you have to mark the roadway in order to make it safe with signs, that you have to do whatever it takes to make it safe. All of that together, Your Honor, is what established the fact that there were three conditions that were proprietary, and that was connected with the issue on negligence, and that was the only issue that was presented. It was all proprietary. As far as anything dealing with design is concerned, there was some testimony about nuisance, obviously, and we went back to the very beginning where we talked about what was being done. But that issue is really not before the court because the Court of Appeals has not passed on it. And the only reason that anything about the road was done was to present evidence that where you couldn't have a bridge, where you couldn't make it absolutely safe, then you had certain common law duties. That is, to mark, to warn, to guard against, and the city failed to do that. And that's what the jury found here. Thank you.
Mr. Knexon?
Good morning.
Please, the court. Before proceeding, I would like to dispel any doubt that the court may have one issue. Not only did Henry Cisneros virtually confess liability and confess negligence, but the City of San Antonio's own expert confessed that they were negligent. I will call the court's attention to
if the mayor testified that he wasn't negligent, would that be conclusive?
No, it would not. At 2389 and 2390 of the Statement of Facts, in cross-examination, Rick Robertson, the city's expert, whether or not, we began with talking about, and this is important, warnings and barricade should have been there in compliance with the standard, correct? And he said in compliance, really, with good engineering practice. And I asked him whether the failure to comply with that standard constitutes a failure to exercise ordinary care. Yes. And the failure to exercise ordinary care is negligence. Yes. So the city of San Antonio was, period, negligent. Yes. We didn't have a proof problem in this case. Ms. Duncan talks about the issue of going back to 1917 and 1931 and going back in time and history discussing this low water crossing. The importance of that was for the punitive damages claim. The importance of that was to show that as far back as 1914, this had been a low water crossing, that Five Points had been a flood zone since time immemorial, and we were not complaining about the construction of the culvert in 1931. We were calling it to the attention of the jury for the jury to understand that this was a hazard that had been there so long that nobody in their right mind could have avoided knowing it was there. We then got into all of the issues and all of the evidence concerning the policy and the systematic attempt by Bob Hahn, the drainage engineer, whom the jury found to be a policymaker, because he was the person ultimately responsible for his tasks, had set out to identify these 200 low water crossings. And then we showed the jury that they had done this, but they had left off all of the inner city, all of downtown, and all of the old parts of town. And the juries could infer, as it obviously did, that that was intentional and not an oversight.
If your proof was so strong on that, how come you included in your gross negligence definition this language about reasonable person that's taken out of a part of Burke Royalty, rather than limiting that instruction to precisely what was said in the city of Gladewater?
Because Gladewater didn't say enough, and we struggled.
Well, it's pretty clear. It seems clear from Gladewater, especially in light of the concurrence, that they're setting up a two-tiered gross negligence test, one for ordinary folks and one for municipalities, and that the municipality test was a lot tougher.
A lot tougher. But did the court intend in Gladewater to tell the jury that they couldn't infer? Did the court, we submit not. We submit that unless we were to be required to prove actual subjective intent to harm, that allowing the jury to infer from acts and conduct is certainly permissible. We went through the case law, we went through existing authority, we went through decisions of this court where some comment had been made regarding inferences the jury could make. That's the only one that we found that was susceptible to being inserted into the instruction. All of the rest of the material in the Gladewater instruction in this case, we were able to pull directly from the cases that this court had cited with approval, including Bennett versus City of Slidell, Peace versus City of Center, Texas, and also the Pace case regarding the malice or maliciousness instruction.
How is this instruction as given in number
6, 5, and 6
any different from Burke Royalty or Williams versus Stevens?
Several particulars. First, the policymaking official, express definition of policymaking official.
Well, I mean, we've got that in the ordinary case when you talk about a principal or vice principal. That's just the analog, is it not?
Item number 5. You told us to ask the jury whether or not the conduct of the city was such that they could, that it would show, and we're back to the show versus indicate issue now, which I think is probably dead, whether or not it was the result of such conscious indifference to the rights, welfare, or safety of the person or persons affected by it to show malice or evil intent. That's what you ask us to, or what you told us to ask the jury. That's what we asked the jury.
By the time you get down to malice and defined in 6B, implied
yes.
malice, aren't you really back to LaCroix?
Under 6B implied malice? We think not. The concept of implied malice referring to a state of mind that is so grossly indifferent to or in reckless disregard of the rights of others as will amount to willful or wanton act.
That sounds to me like it. I don't want to belabor your time, and I'll give you a few extra minutes, but it seems to me that you take the, and I agree show and indicator the same, but you take the exact words of Pike, and then by the time you get through defining those words, we're left with the identical standard that would exist in any gross negligence case.
Your Honor, with all due respect, we think not, because the court has told us recently that we must read the charge as a whole. We must be fair to both the jury and the lawyers. On a whole, the definition here of policymaking official complies with POC. Intentional, no problem. Willful, no problem. Wanton, no problem. Gross negligence. In the direct definition of gross negligence, we require the jury to find malice or evil intent. Maliciousness was, we did not use the 1987 Tort Reform Amendment statutory definition of malice because this was not, that was not the applicable law. And we had already had a major gunfight in this case as to whether or not it was pre- or post-tort reform. Since it was pre-tort reform, we stuck with pre-tort reform matters all the way through. We simply submit that the charge as a whole submits an objective test which requires the jury to find such a degree of conscious indifference as to show malice or evil intent. That was the question asked, and that was what they found.
Can you comment, regardless of that problem?
Sure.
Pike slash Burke Royalty, how this charge stands up in line of Walmart.
Walmart did not exist, of course, at the time.
I understand that. And that's a remand problem if it doesn't stand up in front of that test, perhaps. But,
we
or
think
maybe it's not. But I'm just wondering how it stands up.
We think that certainly the evidence to stand up in the case withstands Walmart. And there has been some discussion as to the standard of review, and we respectfully submit that under any suggested standard of review, this case and the evidence in this case would pass muster.
How does the evidence in this case establish the extreme degree of risk referred to in Walmart?
The extreme degree of risk is that this low water crossing was ultra, ultra hazardous and was ultra, ultra, ultra deceptive in that it was concealed.
Is
that the evidence
the
shows
Box
that.
Canyon, or because you can't tell how deep it was?
Because you, of both. Rick Robertson, again, I asked him at 2396 of the transcript.
The city's expert?
Yes. Isn't this a rather unusual low water crossing, and that we're that this is not just any low water crossing? I mean, generally, you're going to be washed off the road into a flat area or open channel, right? Or he said, yes, this is a low water crossing where if a car washes off the road, it may go into a box culvert. His answer is no, it will. We go one page on, the next line, and I trust you will agree with me that in relation to other low water crossings, that's an ultra, ultra hazardous low water crossing. Answer, yes.
And the other deaths that you had evidence about, the other people that had drowned, were they at this particular one or just a crossing very similar to this?
There had been a death about 100 feet downstream from this point under virtually identical circumstances in 1983. There is an exhibit in the chart that is a list of numbered items. that shows, I think, either 9 or 19 incidents between that time and the time of this occurrence at either this location or block numbers immediately adjacent to this location. And the other business about ultra-hazardous, why they should know and why this is a grossly dangerous situation. Frank Kielbasa, the Director of Public Works, whom under the Charter Section 61, is ultimately and absolutely responsible for maintenance of the streets and drainways, participated in 1985 in a variance procedure with Via Metropolitan Transit, who is the upstream abutting landowner. There are documents that emanated from that procedure. This is more of why we went into the history and more of why we went into the background of this crossing. And in 1985, there was a memorandum from Frank Kielbasa, the Director of Public Works, regarding the danger zone at this location. There were calculations performed, submitted to the City of San Antonio in 1985, the Kielbasa document is Plaintiff's Exhibit 11. Exhibits 30, 31, and 32 by an engineer talking about the danger zone. In 1985, Plaintiff's Exhibit 81 was the calculations by a drainage engineer showing that this area flooded with depths and velocities which put it in the danger zone.
Any other questions?
That will comply.
Thank you, Counsel.
We pray for it.
May it please the Court. When you sue the City, there are three lists. There's a list for proprietary functions, a list for functions that are governmental as to which immunity has been waived, and a list of discretionary governmental functions for which the City has no liability. Those three lists make this a charge error case, and it still is. Nobody has determined, and it's up to this Court to decide, whether or not the plaintiffs have proven that negligence in the proprietary and performance of a proprietary function is the proximate cause in this case. What's not even been mentioned yet is that the jury's comparative fault finding stands or falls upon those definitions. The merger doctrine has never been construed to say that the jury can take into account in assessing the comparative causation the fact that the City had a fire department and chose to provide fire service, the fact that the City chose not to follow its own ordinances for subdivision developers for all-weather crossings. Because question 1B allows the jury to say, I think the City should have put a bridge here first before they put it out on the north side of town by Wurzbach. And there's floodwaters on the road, and but for the new bridge, we wouldn't have this problem. Most importantly, that same jury in this Court's charge, taken as a whole, as Mr. Jackson invites you to construe, said, look at comparative causation and take into account the way the City spends its bond money and which bridges it builds first, which it builds later, and whether or not it carries out its policies effectively. The City of San Antonio was prepared to and went to the courthouse for a month to try this case on proprietary functions. Not only did Mayor Cisneros take the stand, called by the plaintiffs as their witness, and say we should have had a sign here, but I told the jury on my argument, which you'll see in the record, as I pointed to a big picture of a sign about this high and wrote on red letters, no excuse. Everybody from the City said, we didn't follow our own criteria for warnings at this location, and that's a proprietary function. But the plaintiffs weren't satisfied with that. They weren't satisfied. They wanted to go back to 1914 and go through all of the regulatory processes and the committee that Wayne Hubinger was on and the decisions about other low-water crossings.
Isn't
and the allocation.
Isn't that proof relevant to gross negligence?
I believe it is.
They're going to require a pipe-type standard.
Believe it is. Believe that much of that evidence would properly be admissible for a limited purpose, and the problem is that when they get to the charge, contrary to their representations, and I think it's at page 1359 in the record to the trial court, that they're only going to submit proprietary functions. They come in with question 1 that says floodwaters, which could be any of these functions, which clearly can be a failure to regulate the watershed or to build a new bridge, which are just undeniably discretionary functions. But in question two, to get their negligence submission, there's no limitation at all. Those are the two questions that then tie into comparative causation that the jury says 25% for Sandra Rodriguez and 75% for the city. And this court can't know any more than I can know, or as the counsel for the plaintiff at trial can know, what that jury would have said if they were restricted to findings on proprietary functions in that issue. We can't know. That's why the city never had a chance to try this case on its proprietary functions.
Can contrary, you point to places in the argument where counsel argued a bridge should have been built in arguing 1B?
Well, what I can point to in particular, and I don't have a reference to that specifically in the argument, but I do have the specific argument that says there's no doubt about the fact that there is actual or constructive knowledge of a dangerous condition, and it is either the unmarked crossing, the failure to have barricades, or the floodwaters. The jury heard evidence for a 40-year period that included all of the regulatory functions, and the arguments were that the city could have solved this problem in numerous ways. Your Honor, the mayor can't bind the city as to his testimony about negligence, but more importantly, he can't bind the city, and the jury can't find as a fact the issue of proprietary functions. We think it would clearly, under the broad form submission practice, be an inferential rebuttal issue to submit, as Houston versus Bush suggests. In that case, predates broad form submission. It is also founded on non-authorities. One of the cases it cites, which is Edmund, is not even a jury trial case. The other case which it cites involved the merger doctrine, and I want to comment about the merger doctrine because, although I've already mentioned that, the merger doctrine about combined proprietary and governmental functions, like in Daniels, there was no contention that the discretionary choices about whether or not to control parking and how to control it led to the injury. It was just the fact that there was unmarked wet paint. It is an implementation distinction, as Justice Enoch asked. The implementation is a proprietary activity, and that's what Daniels appears to stand for. Under the Gladewater test, Your Honor, I would say that we objected to the charge on the specific basis that it didn't use the paragraph in Gladewater that says you have to show this. Gladewater to us is a conscious indifference with an attitude test for exemplary damages against a municipality. Under the Gladewater test, the court underscored the difference by saying this is an exceedingly difficult burden of proof. I think that some of the arguments in favor of the city's negligence, like what the mayor said, are contrary to any logical inference under Walmart for punitive damages in this case. What's contrary is that the city's officials testified that it was the city policy to have this crossing marked, to have all crossings marked, that they had advanced low water crossing warnings, they had depth gauges at these locations, and that this was merely an implementational error. It was not a policy error. If you go back and look at this court's opinions of Terrell versus State, Forbes versus City of Denton, the discretionary function test, and Carpenter versus Barner, which involved a police officer. It's not the level at which the decision is made, but whether or not it involves policy and discretionary choices. San Antonio had made the discretionary choice to put signs at these locations. There's no policy level choice that meets the Gladewater test.
Mr. Jackson was, I understood Mr. Jackson to be arguing that although the policy was to mark low level water bridges, the implementation that none of the inner city or old neighborhood low level crossings were marked indicated that the policy was not to mark in the inner city.
We believe that that's not a logical inference in the face of the uncontroverted proof that the city's policy was to mark them, the testimony of everyone there about how this place came to be missed, and the fact that there was no evidence of any other low water crossing in the area we're talking about that was not marked, that this was the only one.
Any other questions?
Thank you,
counsel. That concludes the argument. The second call. The court will now take another brief recess.
Yeah,